The other day, by putting the word insole into my computer search engine, that the word brings up advertisements for Dr. Scholl's healthy living footwear, providing the ultimate in comfort and relief. Much as we might like to slip into something more comfortable after our evening meal, I am here to stir you out of that reverie by introducing one of the most capable and interesting, I think, young philosophers of religion teaching in the UK today. It's been my privilege to know and to work with Chris since he was a research fellow at Heathrop College, I think in 2000, and to follow his move to the Divinity Faculty here, and then on to his current post as professor at the University of Durham. His first book, The Politics of Human Frailty, was a study of political liberalism, a theological defense of liberalism, and engaged such thinkers as Richard Hooker and Edmund Burke and John Rawls. And he went on then to edit the Cambridge Companion to Edmund Burke. But he also worked continuously in the field of philosophy of religion. Along with Harriet Harris, they edited a collection of pieces exploring the impact of analytical philosophy on the philosophy of religion. And then Chris published his own book, The Realist Pope, which is a critique of anti-realism in philosophical theology. However, it's for his work and his current work on Immanuel Kant that we've invited him here to this conference on power and the limits of power. His most recent book, Kant and the Creation of Freedom, which you will see downstairs on the book table, has provoked scholars of Kant to notice the connections between his thought and that of his predecessors, particularly Aquinas and Leibniz and Suarez, but also to appreciate the ways in which Kant struggles with the fundamental theological question of God, God's creative action, and human freedom. Indeed, Chris has just given a paper to the Society, the American and British Society of Kantian Scholars at the University of Kiel, and has come over today following that conference. So with all of that in mind, I'm delighted to welcome you to our conference, Chris, and we look forward to hearing your paper, Kant on Christianity, Religion and Politics, Three Hopes, Three Limits. Please will you welcome Chris.
Thank you very much, Susan, for that introduction and for inviting me. And thank you to you all for coming. To the extent that Christianity is taken seriously, John Rawls reflects, it could have deleterious effects on one's character. Rawls describes himself in his last 2 years at Princeton as deeply concerned with theology and its doctrines and had considered going to the seminary, deciding to wait until the war was over. In the last year or so of the war, Rawls explains, all that changed, and a range of Christian doctrines all became impossible for me to take seriously. Not, he says, in the sense that the evidence for them was weak or doubtful, but for moral reasons, concerning ideas of right and justice. A pronounced strand in Rawls's critique is the tendency that he found in Christianity, he paints on a very broad canvas, of identifying a particular group or cause in history with God's will and power, in a way that offers false and dangerous consolation to believers. Rawls recalls being appalled by a sermon given in the field in 1944 by a military pastor. He said that God aimed our bullets at the Japanese while God protected us from theirs. Christian doctrine, Rawls reflected, ought not to be used for that. This line of criticism, shared by others, and not the less forceful for being vague, will be in the hinterland throughout my discussion. So this paper will make two key claims in succession. First of all, Kant's own religious hope is significantly and studiedly distanced from the traditions of Christianity that he would have received, in ways that have not yet been fully or widely appreciated. The headline claim will be that Kant makes an ideal moral community the object of our religious hopes, and not the transcendent God of the tradition. The second claim will be that Kant, nonetheless, has a notion of transcendence at play, but in a strikingly different key to traditional Christianity. Both concepts of transcendence, the Christian and the Kantian, deflate in their own distinctive ways our hopes for politics and history, in a way that can unsettle the certainties and vanities of both the traditional theologian and the secular Rawlsian. The Christian hope is not the same as Kant's religious hope, and Kant's religious hope is distinct in origin, depth, and ambition from his more limited hope for politics. In short, where the Christian hopes for another time, the Rawlsian has hopes for this time, and Kant hopes to be in a space other than time. Some commentators, have deflated the content of Kant's religious hope, effectively identifying it without remainder as one of his regulative ideas, which Kant describes as heuristic fictions, which serve the needs of reason without claiming the status of true beliefs. Now, there's some truth to this identification, but also some error. In theoretical contexts, the idea of God is, for Kant, merely regulative, a condition of the application of reason to nature. But such regulative belief, Kant insists, should not be called practical belief. And that's the important thing. Whilst there is something unstable about merely regulative belief in God, because of difficulties that come up in speculation, it is entirely otherwise, Kant writes, in the case of moral belief. The purpose of the moral law can only be achieved if there be a God and a future world. And Kant claims to know with complete certainty that no one else knows of any other conditions that can guarantee properly ordered happiness. I will inexorably believe, Kant writes, in the existence of God and a future life, and I am sure that nothing can make these beliefs unstable. Determined exponents of a more deflated Kant may find this paper overcommitted to the claim that Kant nurtures a genuine religious hope. Nonetheless, I think the paper can be travelled with, because on any account of the matter, Kant uses the language of the highest good, which is the sort of the crux of his religion. And this concept has a certain shape, whatever its metaphysical status. In a way, the key claim is this, that even on the strongest reading of Kant's religious commitments, he is, in certain key and identifiable respects, not Christian. Distances himself from the traditions that he receives, and put it like that. This distancing from Christianity, as he received it, is not found in Kant's characterization of the divine nature, where what he writes is largely compatible with what the tradition would call the preambles of faith, those aspects of the divine nature that our reason can to some degree approach without the articles of faith that rely upon divine revelation given in Scripture. For Kant, practical reason inexorably leads to the concept of a single, most perfect and rational primordial being, a being of the highest perfection, a highest and all-sufficient being. In less familiar passages, Kant also aligns himself to a distinctively Platonic strand, taken up in part of the Christian tradition, which talks about creation as a diffusion of a plenitude of divine goodness. We find this notion, for example, in Aquinas, who writes that it is evident from the very nature and definition of the good that the good is diffusive of itself and of being. Such diffusion befits God, by virtue of which God is the cause of being for other things. Kant invokes a similar notion of divine diffusion in the 1780s, in other words, well into his critical period. He writes, God cognizes himself by means of his highest understanding, as the all-sufficient ground of everything possible. He is most well pleased with his unlimited faculty as regards all positive things, and it is just this well-pleasedness with himself which causes him to make these possibilities actual. Kant relates such a conception of self-cognition and self-diffusion with the category of the highest good, writing that the deity, although subjectively in need of no external thing, still cannot be thought to shut himself up within himself, but must rather be thought to be determined to produce the highest good beyond himself just by his consciousness of his all-sufficiency. So it's at this point, I think, where we seem close to the Christian tradition, where we come across the first and in some ways all-significant difference. In scholastic theology, the highest good of creation, as the fitting diffusion of divine goodness, is always identified not with a perfect world, but with the beatific vision of God, enjoyed by the blessed, of which the incarnation, the hypostatic union of God and man, is the paradigm and the means. So in a way that would be quite alien to Kant's religious hope, the highest good is above all Christ, and not Christ as an example of a perfect Kantian, but as a living reality with whom we are in relationship, such that through Christ we can enjoy the life of God in the beatific vision. In Aquinas, as Aquinas exegetes the theological tradition, we find a Platonic logic of diffusion leading inexorably to Christ. Aquinas writes, "It belongs to the essence of the highest good, summum bonum, to communicate itself in the highest manner to the creature. And this is brought about chiefly by his so joining created nature to himself that one person is made up of these three, the word, a soul, and flesh, as Augustine says. Hence it is manifest that it was fitting that God should become incarnate." The beatific vision achieved in and through Christ was, for all scholastic theologians, the highest created good, creation at its highest point, enjoying God's own self-communication. I think such perilously generalised assertions about all scholastic theologians are made possible by virtue of the common core of scholastic theology. So to become a master of theology in the medieval university system, one was required to write an appreciative commentary on Peter Lombard's Book of Sentences. Lombard's sentences are largely a compilation of passages from Augustine, who is clear that God is the highest uncreated good, and the beatific vision of God, the highest created good. There are, of course, nuances, differences, and distinctions within the medieval tradition about the relative priority of our willing or knowing in the beatific vision, about how precisely we might say God is seen, and about whether our desire is satiated or continuously expands into God. But I think all of these subtleties need not concern us, as the largest differences in scholastic thought about the highest good amount to very little in comparison to the difference between all of them and Kant's conception. So Kant agrees with the tradition that God, as the supreme being, the all of reality, is the highest uncreated good, or as Kant puts it, the highest original good. The rupture emerges, though, with Kant's account of the highest created good, which for Kant does not revolve around the enjoyment of and participation in God. What alone constitutes the highest good, Kant writes in the First Critique, is happiness in exact proportion with the morality of rational beings through which they are worthy of it. Now, the lexical field that Kant explores when discussing his conception of the highest good faithfully maps onto the terms that are associated in the medieval tradition with the concept of the summum bonum. To avoid any arbitrary comparison of scholastic theology with Kant, I restrict myself here to discussing only Kant's own lexical choices, which include summum bonum, beatitude, the final end of creation, and the glorification and honouring of God, which in the medieval tradition are the terms associated with the enjoyment of God's diffusion of God's goodness. In each case, I attempt to understand Kant's distinctive and quietly subverting usage in relation to the tradition from which he receives these categories. Kant's most dramatic discontinuity with the traditions he receives, I will suggest, comes when he rejects the idea that God could be an object that is good without limit for our will or practical reason, alongside his rejection of the medieval notion of divine human concursus. Towards the end of this section, I will dispatch the suggestion that Kant might nonetheless be a sort of Lutheran. Let us begin then with Kant on beatitude. For Aquinas, beatitude consists only in the contemplation of God, as the ultimate end of man is knowledge of God. In discussing the prospect of a future of beatitude, Kant explains that this is the expression that reason employs to designate a complete well-being independent of all contingent causes in the world. The precise phrasing here is noteworthy. Beatitude is the expression that reason employs. So it seems that the project of translating the categories of historical revealed religion into the religion of pure practical reason is not something that Kant only begins in his 1793 text, Religion Within the Boundaries of Mere Reason. So according to Kant's translation, beatitude is a state where nature and morals come into harmony, where rational beings devote themselves with their whole soul to the moral law. The Christian principle of morals, he explains, is not theological. It does not make cognition of God and his will the basis of these laws, but only of the attainment of the highest good, subject to the condition of observing these laws. So beatitude is the state of undistracted devotion to the moral law. God is needed to support and reward the attainment of this state, but we should not overlook the fact that beatitude is no longer, as it is for the tradition, itself the cognition of God and his will. In the scholastic tradition, the notion of the glorification or glory of God stands, quite precisely, for the enjoyment of the communication of divine goodness, expressed paradigmatically in the beatific vision. So Kant continues his translation project. He reflects that when thinkers describe the highest good, or the end of creation, as the glory of God, they have perhaps hit upon the best expression. A phrasing which nicely indicates Kant's self-conscious reconfiguring of the tradition. He says, "For nothing glorifies God more than what is most estimable in the world, respect for his command, observance of the holy duty that his law lays upon us, when there is added to this his magnificent plan of crowning such a beautiful order with corresponding happiness." Although softly, even piously put, we note that glorification is no longer at all the enjoyment of God's self-communication, but rather observance of the moral law, met with proportionate happiness. Because God and the highest good are so intimately linked in Kant's thought, and because Kant himself at times praises a Christian conception of the highest good, in comparison with Epicurean and Stoic conceptions, it is easy to get the impression that Kant is following established Christian patterns of thought. So it's in part based upon passages that a Kant commentator called Frederick Beiser affirms that the most striking aspect of Kant's reflections on the highest good is, as he puts it, Kant's self-conscious allegiance to the Christian, indeed Protestant, tradition. It is a point that cannot be stressed enough, Beiser says. Kant saw his ethics as Christian doctrine. Now, I think it's true that Kant saw aspects of Christian doctrine as compatible with his ethics, but the difference between Kant and traditional Christian patterns of thought with reference to the highest good can be summarised precisely. For traditional Christianity, the highest good is the communication of God's own being, paradigmatically expressed in the incarnation and the beatific vision. For Kant, the highest good is a state of perfect justice, where happiness is distributed in proportion to virtue, and where both virtue and happiness are defined without a central reference to God. Happiness, Kant tells us, is the state of a rational being in the world, in the whole of whose existence everything goes according to his wish and will, where the wish and will of a rational being must be determined to virtue, which consists in following the moral law, such that morality consists in the laws of the generation of true happiness from freedom in general. In the Christian conception, God is the central constituent element of the highest created good, as that which is enjoyed, known, and loved in this state. In Kant's schema, the highest good is a world of intelligences acting in accordance with universal and necessary moral laws. God is in this community, certainly, as a sovereign and as a holy will, but the movement and structure on this conception is horizontal, between rational moral agents of which God is an ideal instance, rather than vertical between creatures and the Creator. So it's worth, I think, being attentive to the precise terms in which Kant does single out praise for Christianity. So in relation to Stoicism and Epicureanism, what he says is, the doctrine of Christianity, even if it is not regarded as a religious doctrine, gives on this point, the relationship between happiness and virtue, a concept of the highest good of the kingdom of God, which alone satisfies the strictest demand of practical reason. So you'll see that what Kant doesn't say here is that Christianity is true. He says that on this point, Christianity has understood something that Stoicism and Epicureanism do not see, which is that happiness and morality are specifically quite different elements of the highest good. Rather than happiness being found in the consciousness of one's morality, as in Stoicism, or in the moralised curtailing of one's desires, as in Epicureanism. The heavy lifting in this claim is done by the term the strictest demand of practical reason, in relation to which, when considering the precept of morals, Christianity has an advantage over other schools of thought. Now, Kant's most dramatic theological move, which I submit unambiguously reveals the philosopher distancing himself from all previous Christian theology, Lutheran or Catholic, is not where we might expect. It is buried in the groundwork and in a rather recondite discussion in chapter 2 of the Analytic of the Second Critique. So in the groundwork, Kant searches for that which is unconditionally necessary and for that which can be considered good without limitation. In searching for the unconditioned, Kant is looking for a reality or principle that is sufficient by itself and in itself to move our will. Kant writes that if the will seeks the law in a property of any of its objects, heteronomy always results. The will in that case does not give itself the law. Instead, the object, by means of its relation to the will, gives the law to it. Now, we can only understand what Kant's doing here if we grasp what he means by an object. Now, an object for Kant can mean here any reality whatsoever, of any ontological texture, created or uncreated, and not only empirical objects or created substances. So an object can be a table, but it can be the essence of poetry, or the uncreated perfection that is God. So the essence of poetry can be the object of our thought without being an object, just so with God. When Kant insists that no object external to the will's own activity can be good without limit and so have unconditioned value for our practical reason and will, he means precisely what he says. All objects are rejected, no matter how elevated, created or uncreated. Kant's departure from the theological tradition lies in his denial that even God could constitute an unconditioned and good without limitation object for our practical reason and will. No theologian had ever before offered a similar denial or anything close to one. Rather, the universal claim in the prior tradition, which we find intact in Kant's sources such as Leibniz, is that only God is the proper and final object of our willing and knowing. I think commentators don't always see the drama of Kant's move here, and they focus on more obvious targets such as commands, sensations, pleasure, rewards. But Kant is clear that he rejects all objects that could be presented to the will. So after in the groundwork rejecting the obvious candidates, he turns to the very principle of perfection. His explicit target here is the universal practical philosophy of Christian Wolff, where the identification of perfection and God is clear. In the second critique, Kant comments that the occasion and ground of all the errors of philosophers, when searching for that which is good without limitation, is the search for an object of the will. The point is, I think, is that it's not the unworthiness of the object that concerns Kant, but it's the fact of receiving anything at all, anything external to the will. Because as Kant writes, anything which presents itself as an object of the will is excluded from the determining grounds of the will called the unconditionally good. Even when the object is happiness, perfection, or the will of God, any principle external and prior to the will's own universal law-giving is heteronomy. For Kant, freedom is destroyed when the will is moved at all, even if the external object that moves the will is perfection itself. Freedom cannot be divided, Kant insists, such that the human being is either entirely free or not free at all. Freedom must be a faculty of starting events from itself, without the causality of the cause itself having to begin, and hence without need for any other ground to determine its beginning. This has the implication for Kant that if God, who Kant calls an alien cause, acts upon our will, our freedom is destroyed, where freedom for Kant is the inner value of the world. So Kant has a zero-sum conception of the relationship between divine and human action. For the human to be free, God must withdraw. Kant explicitly rejects the traditional notion of concursus or concurrence, where what that means is that divine and human action can be understood uniquely as running together in a single undivided free action. Kant writes, "It is not permitted to think of God's concursus with free actions. If God concurs with morality, then the human being has no moral worth, because nothing can be imputed to him." So in denying concursus, Kant squarely sets his face against medieval theology, and in insisting that our true freedom comes from ourselves alone in relation to the good we ourselves must do, and where the will has as its object not God, but itself as giving universal law, Kant also offends the deepest Lutheran instinct that we have no freedom and no goodness except that which comes as a sheer gift from God. For the Lutheran, our moral transformation towards virtue, sanctification, depends entirely upon divine action and follows from our being justified by Christ and is in no way the cause of this justification. Free will, Luther writes in the Heidelberg Confession, is dead, as demonstrated by the dead whom the Lord has raised up, as the holy teachers of the church say. For Kant, if there is grace, a divine supplement, he calls it, it must come, if at all, only consequent to our own free action. In contrast, Luther writes that the person who believes that he can obtain grace by doing what is in him adds sin to sin, so that he becomes doubly guilty. Now, all of this isn't to deny the significance of positive ways in which Kant conceives of God being involved in upholding and maintaining the state, which is the highest good. So God, Kant describes him, as the sovereign in the kingdom of ends. Kant says we should regard all duties as divine commands, although the content of these duties is given in the moral law, determined independently of the divine will. God, as the holy will, can, unlike us, do no other than follow the moral law, and will always be, therefore, for Kant, a first among equals within the moral community of the kingdom of ends. God, as omniscient, knows our virtue, and as omnipotent, can ensure that happiness is appropriately distributed, and as benevolent will do so. God provides a supplement to our own moral efforts in our constantly precarious attempts to be good. More speculatively, there are fragmentary hints in Kant, especially in his final writings, that God becomes in some sense identified with the divinity within us, which is our own legislating and following of the moral law. All of these strands are important and prima facie evidence of Kant's genuine religiosity, but all of them depart from the central claim of the Christian tradition, which is that God, and not just the moral law which God necessarily commands, is the all-satiating endpoint and final object of our loving and knowing, and where God is, in the technical terms employed here, an external object, and so not coextensive with our own moral law-giving, who nonetheless, and uniquely, acts interiorly within creatures, in all they do, in a way that does not violate but constitutes their freedom. In relation to this claim, for the traditional theologian, Kant's God seems awkwardly on the outskirts of the kingdom of ends, or to disappear entirely within it. So one sometimes finds the claim, for instance, in John Rawls, that Kant's conception of the highest good is, as he puts it, a surviving Leibnizian remnant, which Kant should have removed if he'd been faithful to his own philosophical self-discipline and ethical standards. But when we get to the details, I think, we find that, as with Lutheranism, not much of what Leibniz would affirm is left remaining. For Kant, God is not a proper external object for our practical reason and will, and loving and knowing God is not our highest good, in contrast to Leibniz's repeated and traditioned assertion that God is the only proper object of our knowing and willing, and where knowing and loving God is our final end and our highest good, achieved by God's concurring action within our freedom. God alone is our immediate external object, writes Leibniz. He alone is our light, where the greatest happiness is when God is the object of our love. What remains from both Leibniz and Luther are remnants of remnants, gutted of their traditional content and reconstrued in terms that are vividly and emphatically Kant's own, thoroughly motivated by principles deep in his wider philosophy. Kant's religion is properly Kantian. Within Kant's religion of pure practical reason, we can find a philosophically well-motivated and, on some construals, epistemically disciplined, in Kant's terms, post-Christian philosophical theology. Post-Christian in its rejection of core strands of doctrinal commitment as Kant receives them, but also perhaps pre-Christian. If we follow the tendril of some of Kant's priorities and commitments back through Leibniz and into a Renaissance Platonic humanism, which we know to have been strong in 17th century Germany, especially in Leipzig, where Leibniz studied. Although I can't do more than gesture towards it here, I want to suggest that it is at least as illuminating and probably more charitable to investigate Kant's religious hope as an epistemically disciplined and adapted form of Platonism, albeit dressed in Christianized language, as it is to regard these hopes as a locked-off derivative or heretical schism from Christianity. For Kant, as in Platonism, human flourishing involves a deepening participation in a structure of reason that transcends the individual and the particular, where reason seeks its resting place in the unconditioned. Autonomy, whereby we give ourselves the rational law, which is itself the shape of our own grasping of the rational law, can be construed, I think, as a variant on a perennial classical paradigm, where that which has unconditioned value is thought thinking itself, and rational will willing itself. In the 1790s, Kant reflects that a hidden idea of philosophy has long been present among men. This idea, he says, goes back to the ancient Greek philosophers, whose principal object is the destination of man and the means to achieve it. The true idea of the philosopher, as Kant puts it, is expressed by Plato's Socrates, as one seeking and never quite reaching the idea of reason, the idea of wisdom. So this will be a hint I return to in the final moments of the paper, but we turn now, though, to a consideration of Kant's hopes for politics and history. The highest created good, then, for Kant, is a moral community, a great whole, a systematic unity of ends in a world of intelligences, acting in accordance with universal and necessary moral laws. So in this state of the highest good, we are not centrally referred or oriented to the transcendence of God. The notion of transcendence derives etymologically from the Latin term transcendere, to go beyond. The concept of transcendence need not enter our thought as a presence, a possession, and a foundation, but can act subversively upon our thinking by marking a space that goes beyond our knowledge, experience, and competence. Everything that is can be relativized, rendered to a degree passive and dependent by virtue of the transcendence which goes beyond it. Amongst other things, the Christian notion of transcendence can draw our attention to God being the uncreated and inexhaustible source of all that is created, where every texture of creation is equidistantly and totally dependent upon God, who always goes beyond, and where God is in no sense reciprocally dependent upon the creation. Now, my eventual claim will be that Kant does have a robust and ethico-religiously relevant conception of the transcendent, that which always and everywhere goes beyond. But the structure of this transcendence, this going beyond, is significantly different from the Christian tradition which he received. There are two groups of commentators, I find, who do not usually come together, but who join in not seeing this differently structured transcendence in Kant. So the one group would be traditional theologians, especially those with an Augustinian strand in their thought, and the other group would be secular Rawlsians, or at least one Rawlsian, Rawls himself. So first of all, I want to set out how this shared lack of appreciation for Kant's differently structured transcendence manifests itself. I find that it becomes especially apparent and distorting when reflecting upon Kant's hopes for politics and history. Both the Rawlsian and the Augustinian theologian often think that Kant has significant faith, using the word advisedly, in human reason and progress in history. I show in turn that Rawls celebrates this, whilst the theologian laments it. I then move on to consider how Kant's distinctive conception of transcendence subverts the hopes for history and politics imputed to him from both sides. So having rejected what Rawls calls the Leibnizian remnant of the highest good in Kant's writings, Rawls goes on to salvage what he considers a reasonable faith in the kingdom of ends. Such reasonable faith, Rawls insists, does require certain beliefs about our nature and the social world. We must believe, Rawls writes, note, we must believe, that the course of human history is progressively improving and not becoming steadily worse, or that it does not fluctuate in perpetuity from bad to good and good to bad. Such improvement will lead, Rawls avows, to a peaceful international society or confederation of peoples, each people organised as a state with some kind of constitutional representative regime. To abandon this faith, Rawls insists, is to give up on peace and democracy, and that we can never do as long as we affirm both the moral law and human freedom. Well, it can seem initially that Rawls is in continuity with Kant's own hopes for historical progress. When Kant writes, for example, that the great artist nature brings about progress in history, Kant tracks a progression from a state of unsocial sociability, expressed in antagonism and cooperation, which then generates skill and culture, bringing about both war and the spirit of commerce. All of this we can regard as leading, Kant says, in the future to a state of perpetual peace, safeguarded by a cosmopolitan world order. When viewed from a moral perspective, Kant calls such progress in history providence, which, although not in itself a consideration that justifies belief in God, serves, he says, as does any indication of teleology in nature, as a desired confirmation of the moral argument for God, insofar as nature is thus capable of displaying something analogous to the moral ideas of reason. Well, Rawls insists that religious beliefs are not needed for his practical faith in progress. we can go further. Christian religious belief, at least when containing a strong Augustinian strain, is not only not needed, but positively antithetical to such faith. So the contemporary North American theologian Charles Matthews objects, primarily upon ethical grounds, to Kantian moral arguments for the value of faith in God. Such arguments, he complains, suggest that God's value lies in underwriting, orienting, and energizing our moral projects, expressed in various forms of belief in progress. In contrast, a certain sort of theologian will draw attention to what Karl Barth names as the essential, sharp, acid, and disintegrating absolute distance between God and creatures. So this distance is typically worked out in terms of our temporality. For Augustine, we live in hoc saeculo, in this age or time, from which etymologically the notion of the secular is derived. The secular, in this sense, describes a period of time from the creation until Judgment Day. We live in this time, waiting and enduring for the new time, the secular saeculorum, the age of ages, which is brought about not by our efforts and achievements, but by divine action. All our existence in this time, the secular, is structurally limited by imperfection, longing, and sin. So the appropriate pattern of life within this framework is one understood as peregrinatio, pilgrimage, wandering, or as the contemporary theologian Matthews puts it, you know he's contemporary, that's for the Kantians, right? Enduring life, enduring the world. Such ascetic enduring, as Matthew describes it, is a matter of vulnerability more than toughness, about learning to suffer in the right way. The yearning for transcendence, Matthew comments, is typically misunderstood, not least by Christians, and should not be construed as otherworldly, in the sense that we are perhaps made for another place, a metaphysical Mars, perhaps, this is Matthew's, whilst for some obscure reason we are trapped in this one. Rather, Christians are not otherworldly, but most fundamentally other temporalityed. The world is more primordially an era than a place. Matthews talks of living within a tensive structure of commitment and longing, where as much as anything we must cultivate appropriate dissatisfactions. So the contrasting and undercutting work done by transcendence, I think we can see, has a sharp edge politically. Specifically, it can block the identification of particular groups or causes with God, which rules, rightly, found a distressing feature of Christianity in the field. God aims our bullets. Such a conception of transcendence can undercut a confidence in, even a hopeful orientation towards, historical and political progress. So the Augustine commentator Paul Griffiths reflects that an approach that emphasises peregrinatio will find most kinds of political progressivism, the view that we can in this age significantly improve our politics, to be utopian, such that progressivism may never be endorsed by Christians. The outcome, Griffiths writes, of even our best efforts will always be, in a formal sense, exactly the same, an unpredictable blend of the good and the dreadful. Curiously mirroring, then, the ethical concerns about Christianity expressed by rules, we find a constellation of Christian thinkers, broadly in the Augustinian tradition, begin to articulate a set of ethical concerns about Kantian hope. Specifically, that it is, in a sense, too religious, or more precisely, too religious about what reason and human action can do in hoc saeculo, in the secular. If the theologian was to be mischievously pedantic, she might suggest that Rawls's Kant risks not being secular enough, according at least to the concept's eschatological etymology, where the significance of this time and its local aspirations are suspended and relativised. Rawls accuses Christianity of absolutising human projects, whilst the theologian finds in Rawls the same absolutising move in relation to liberal constitutional democracy. A quasi-religious faith in a particular political arrangement has its own peculiar dangers, the worry would be, if and when there is any self-satisfaction at having no religious beliefs. But I think such an alignment of Kant with a religious optimism about moral history is far too quick. It pushes, I suspect, Kant into too Christian a mindset, with the paradigm of moving from one temporality into another temporality, from historical progress into the moral state. If the Rawlsian learns that he may miss transcendence more than he expected, the Christian theologian might find that Christianity has no monopoly upon transcendence. We should begin by considering all the things that historical progress for Kant is not. It is not, or not straightforwardly, moral progress at all. So in his essay on perpetual peace, Kant affirms that a republican constitution, which is completely compatible with the right of human beings, could be achieved even by a nation of devils, even if only they have understanding. This is because the problem of founding a state is not concerned with the moral improvement of human beings, but only the mechanism of nature, where human beings have to constrain one another to submit to coercive law, and so bring about a condition of peace in which laws have force. In 1798, Kant writes that we can never observe an ever-growing quantity of morality with regard to intention, but only an increase of the products of legality and dutiful actions, whatever their motives. This is because we only ever have empirical data, experiences, upon which we are founding this prediction, namely the physical cause of our actions as these actually occur as phenomena and not the moral cause. Even the realisation of the ideal of an international cosmopolitan society, wherein all external relations are conducted rightfully, could occur without the moral foundation in humanity having to be enlarged in the least. Now, Kant tracks this limitation in what we can infer from empirical deeds back to his transcendental idealism. What's that? Well, all we need to know is it's the claim that all we can ever experience in the world is the world as it is received through our spatial and temporal forms of intuition. Where moral freedom, if it exists, and we must presuppose that it does, must exist in the world prior to and independently of this spatial and temporal reception of the world. All that we can ever experience is that which appears, or the phenomenon. And the whole history of good deeds and progress, no matter how glorious, resides alone in phenomena, in that which appears, and not the moral cause. Now, you may know that precisely what Kant is committing himself to with his transcendental idealism, it's hugely contested. Because the notion of a timeless freedom, calls it a noumenal freedom, that which underlies, that which appears, seems so scandalous to our modern sensibilities, an attractive option is to construe transcendental idealism in less troublesome ways. These tend to be the ways in which it's done in Kant circles. Perhaps Kant really means to indicate the irreducible limitations and complexity of discerning reality, which limitations become especially pronounced when we regard the growth and formation of moral character. Alternatively, another way, perhaps all he means is a sort of grammatical reflection that reasons operate in a conceptual space other than causes, so transcendent in that they do not appear in space and time, but without any spookier connotation. I associate my own research with strands of Kant's scholarship that identify considerable continuity between his earlier rationalist metaphysics and his mature critical philosophy. Alongside some others, I even consider the continuity of this rationalist metaphysics to be compatible with Kant's own claims to have achieved, by his own lights, a new epistemic discipline in his later thoughts. So putting it very briskly, the idea is this. The content of much of what Kant believes in his early thought, God, divine creation, non-spatial and non-temporal human souls, remains much the same in his later thought. But the epistemic status changes from knowledge to warranted and required true beliefs, arrived at on the basis of practical reason, where practical reason is always supporting the project of morality. So I'm going to say something next, which I think that exponents of less extravagant construals of transcendental idealism agree with, and then I'm going to conclude the paper on a more extravagant note, with some brief comments about lines of justification I might explore, if space and time allowed, and if it wasn't so late. First of all, then, the big tent observation. However we construe such language, Kant does choose to talk a lot, continuously through the 1780s and 90s, so his critical period, about our fundamental non-temporality, especially in relation to freedom and morality. This choice, however we construe it, subverts the progressivism about history and politics, as well as indicating a different paradigm and structure for transcendence and hope than that employed in the Christian traditions received by Kant. On any interpretation of transcendental idealism, the need to identify progress in history is described by Kant as a merely regulative idea. index not to a hidden insight into divine purposes, but rather arising from our limited cognitive abilities. Because we cannot hope even to understand how sheer mechanism that no intention has ordered can bring about even the generation of a blade of grass. Newton can't account for the blade of grass. We find it necessary to think in terms of natural teleology, especially in the sphere of biology, of which, perhaps surprisingly, human history for Kant is a subsection. This is a necessity, then, that goes from the micro, the internal organic constitution of the blade of grass, to the macro, the course of that part of mechanical organic nature that we call human history. So it means that a more gifted cognizer, not constrained by receiving the world spatially and temporally, might well have no need to make regulative recourse to something beyond mechanism in order to understand the blade of grass or human history. But the hope for the highest good in Kant's thought has a quite different pedigree, status and destiny to any hope we might have for historical progress. So Kant tells us in the third critique that the moral proof for the existence of God as the guarantor of the highest good would always remain in force, even if we found in the world, which includes the part of nature which is human history, no material for physical teleology at all. The seam of thought that runs from the highest good to God is, Kant tells us, essentially different, indeed entirely independent, from anything that concepts of nature can contain and teach. That is, from any regulative warrant and need to ascribe teleology to nature, which includes history. As such, belief in the highest good, which is practical and not merely regulative, has a securer epistemic status in Kant's system than belief in historical progress. So the picture suggested by Kant on the construal I'm presenting is one where history is not preparatory for a future moral state, but is or might be an emanation of a fundamental moral reality. So those prepared to travel down more metaphysically committed paths of Kant exegesis might say that the history of human actions, as with everything that appears, is the appearance of that which is fundamentally non-spatial and non-temporal, where there is no sense in which we move towards or further away from the noumenal dimension wherein morality resides. Everything that appears, all phenomena, are equidistant, equally disclosing and veiling of ultimate reality. So as Kant puts it, actions here in the world are mere schemata of the intelligible actions. Intelligible always means noumenal, outside of space and time. Where these appearances, the actions, are interconnected in accordance with empirical laws. As a phenomenon of the character, where one imputes a moral status to oneself insofar as one cognizes one's own character only from the phenomenas. The category of morality cannot be used, or not straightforwardly, to describe how we appear, individually, collectively, or historically, but regards the human being considered as noumenon, that's Kant, with the object that it can set for itself as the highest end, the highest good in the world. So for this reason, Kant emphasises the invisibility of moral action, stating, for example, in the groundwork, that it is absolutely impossible by means of experience to make out with complete certainty a single case in which the maxim of an action, otherwise in conformity with duty, rested simply on moral grounds and on the representation of one's duty. Although we cannot see through to our fundamental disposition, we make a fallible inference from perceptions that are only appearances of a good or bad disposition. So if Kant is committed to noumenal freedom in this strong sense, this in itself, by Kant's own lights, need not exclude the proper study of the textures of appearing, everywhere but nowhere in particular, of noumenal freedom in disciplines such as anthropology, social science, history, and psychology. And Kant is very interested in all these disciplines, and it's one of the reasons given sometimes for not reading him as committed to noumenal freedom. But I think such an interest in these disciplines might even be precisely what we expect of Kant, when he tells us that anthropology, for example, is a way of cognizing the interior of the human being from the exterior. This is consonant with the role of appearances outlined above, as the only, albeit precariously limited, means by which we can make inferences about our fundamental moral character. The irreducible and in principle precariousness of the medium could even motivate careful empirical study. Incidentally, Kant's empirical study of the English character would seem to indicate that not all is well in noumenal England. He is aware and unfailingly sarcastic about the pride the English take in their constitutional political arrangements. Magna Carta or not, Kant observes that although for his compatriots the Englishman establishes great benevolent institutions unheard of among all the peoples, the foreigner who has been driven to England's soil by fate and has fallen on hard times can die on the dunghill because he is not an Englishman, that is, not a human being. I do not say then, I'm not saying that such a conception of noumenal atemporal freedom is not difficult for us, and hardly a gripping, intuitive, or useful account, at least by itself, of the moral life. But some things which are difficult for us might not have been so problematic for Kant, whose antennae for plausibility must be, to some extent, framed by his rationalist heritage, used to conceiving of the experienced world as a well-founded phenomenon, grounded upon a fundamentally different underlying reality. So Kant could, by his own account, move a long way from Leibniz, but still not be one of us. So in Kant's chosen association of morality with the language of non-temporality, and especially on the more metaphysically committed interpretation of Kant, we discover a fascinating reassertion of a type of undercutting an omnipresent transcendence, but in a different key to the one we find in the Christian tradition. Noumenal reality sustains and generates the experienced world. It undercuts everywhere our confident assertions about its nature. Because, as with the non-spatial and non-temporal first cause of classical Christianity, it is not inserted into any one place or time in particular. Only the total transcendence guarantees such ubiquitous immanence, and serves as a source of hope that how things appear is not how things fundamentally are, alongside a constant deflation of our confident claims at absolute knowledge. There is a difference, though, in the source and shape of the transcendence. In Augustinian Christianity, God, the creator ex nihilo, is the source, with the mode of unveiling being fundamentally temporal. We live in this age expecting the eschaton, in the eschaton, to be differently temporalized in the age of ages by the gracious action of a transcendent God. In Kant, the source of the transcendence is more our own divinity, as we participate in a fundamental and invisible way in a self-transcending reason, which constitutes the moral law. We do not hope to be differently temporalized, but rather to be, in a fundamental way, other than temporalized, where time is the moving image of our own eternity. So in 1798, Kant asks, what underlies the idea of a political constitution in harmony with the natural right of human beings? What underlies all political forms, Kant asserts, is a Platonic ideal. That is, as he goes on to explain, a res publica noumenon, of which we have in our experience, the disclosing and veiling appearance, the res publica phenomenon. This is transcendence, but differently organized. We live not in hoc seculo, hoping for the city of God. Rather, we experience the res publica phenomenon, trusting and hoping in its not impossible, and therefore to be believed in foundation, in the res publica noumenon, with the locus of our hope being our own proper selves, moral, free, invisible, everywhere acting because nowhere in particular. The res publica noumenon, Kant insists, is not an empty figment of the brain, but rather the eternal norm for all civil organisation in general. So the Christian theologian might not find in Kant's thought theology's other, the secular, but perhaps another theology, for whom the secular, this time, is not fundamental. Thank you for your patience.
We have a few minutes for, we have a good time for questions. Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And look forward to seeing your looking at your hands going up in the air and calling on you.
No questions.
Chris, say a little bit more about Kant on hope.
Right.
I'm just hearing all sorts of resonances in your presentation of Kant that hadn't occurred to me before about the nature of hope.
Right.
You know, I can see that there's a sort of gap that opens up between what we expect or would like to know and what we can't grasp.
Yes.
But what is this hope?
Yeah, no,
what
good.
What is hope?
Kant has a very, I think, classical analysis of this. So, when it comes to morality, practical reason, which is ordered towards the good, has what he calls a priority. As long as theoretical reason doesn't know that it's not true, if practical reason sees that something is required in order to sustain the project of morality, it must believe it. And theoretical reason, as long as it can't show that it's somehow contradictory or impossible, theoretical reason has to step back. So Kant thinks that the first thing you need for morality is freedom, and this troubles a lot of Kant scholars, but he also thinks that it ought to be the case that being moral leads to happiness. It's not that happiness is the incentive, but it ought to be the case that being moral leads to happiness. And the only way in which this could happen, he thinks, is if there is a God and a future life. And he uses Hoffnung, he uses kind of hope, but he explains it in terms of Glauber, belief, and he has an entirely pristine Thomist analysis of what faith is. So, you know, in Thomas, faith is the hybrid, isn't it, whereby you assent to something with the certainty appropriate to knowledge, yeah, although you have evidence only appropriate to opinion, but you do it using the will with absolute certainty. And Kant, in the canon of the First Critique, has pristine this analysis. Opinion, Meinung, Glaube, Wissen. And he describes it in exactly the same terms. And throughout says that Glaube is a case where we assent with our will to that which we must hope for with absolute certainty. So sometimes I think people get confused when reading Kant because they find the language of the will there. And well, surely not. No, I mean, they find the language of the will there when it comes to believing. So Kant talks about it being subjective, you know, you choose to believe, and they think there's an element of voluntarism. But I think that's unwarranted, because it's exactly what you'd expect Kant to say if he's using this medieval analysis of faith, which he is. Of course, what he thinks freedom is totally different. Because in medieval tradition, it's God acting in us, which moves the will. Not for Kant, absolutely not. It's our own will acting morally. It's a moral requirement to believe in God.
And is that the sense in which hope would still be a virtue for him?
Hope is a virtue, but it's not, I suppose, an emotion primarily. Or not fundamentally. It's this state of firm assent to the belief in that which you cannot know. It's okay if you have an emotion, but it shouldn't be based on the emotion. Yes.
Do introduce yourself.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, Mina Bowlby, and I'm a research fellow at St. John's College in Durham. Well, I think the place where Kant gets emotional is when he's talking about duty, sublime and mighty name. But the thing that's always puzzled me about Kant is that he gets so excited about duty, and it's just, I love that little bit in the Second Critique. But he can't really account very well for why it is that we consistently fail to find the categorical imperative within ourselves. We just don't do it.
Yeah.
I mean, he talks about it a bit in the religion, but, you know, if we're going to have hope and we're going to get anywhere, we have to have some sort of resource for fighting and clearing ground, or whatever it is. What is it that we need to do to uncover the categorical imperative, that sort of that moral law within us, and find somehow the motivation to, you know, test and to conform our will?
Yeah, I agree. It can't really does have a problem, because it can look sometimes as if Kant's saying, well, we'd be all right except for our sensuous temptations and impulses. They're the thing that pull us off. But no, actually, it's not. Because the realm at which the moral decision happens is outside of space and time, where my temporal empirical biography of our incontinence and intemperance is in fact an unfolding of as a consequence of my free noumenal action. There's no sensuous impulses in the noumenal realm. So it does make, and he's clear about this, and he knows it, both in the second critique, becomes clear in Religion Within the Limits, that is inexplicable, our turning away from the good. Now, I suppose I find that even one of the more attractive features of Kant is, I suppose there is a sort of strand of Augustine, isn't it, De Libero Arbitrio,
radical evil, yeah.
Where radical evil is by its nature inexplicable, and in De Libero Arbitrio, if I told you I did not know what this turning away was, you wouldn't be satisfied that there is, I don't know. And Kant himself says that Genesis is the laying out of our incomprehension in a historical narrative. I said where we then struggle is that Kant has no way, I think, ultimately, even with God there, Kant has no way of getting us out of this situation. Is God is only there to guarantee the possibility of the highest good, but God can't act in our actions. So how is it ever going to happen? In the end,
how do we achieve spontaneity?
God's there to produce the highest good, but God's not allowed to, because that would impute, that would mean that we're no longer free. I think he kind of knows that. Because by his final writings, he says, "Is God real? Where is God?" And the answer seems to be, God is not a being outside of us. God is in our own commanding of the moral law. God is so it sort of thoroughly immunizes it.
Thank you very much for a wonderful paper. John Berkman, Toronto. I found this fascinating. I mean, both trying to see where you saw him following and then departing from the main lines of the scholastic tradition. And what you were just talking about, it seems to me where the penny drops is this understanding of freedom and the zero-sum game over divine and human action. And even what you just said about kind of God is when we are acting kind of fully autonomously, it's... can you say a little bit more about why he thinks this has to be a zero-sum game? How he deals with various scholastic accounts of how both we can act freely and how God can act in us. I know it's a huge question, but I would, if you could sketch out why you think, or are there particular arguments why he thinks that tradition of arguments fails?
It's a really good question. And I think it's very hard to know. I really did try to find out. Because in the 1760s, 50s, he's in the 1750s and 60s, he's entirely happy to say that God determines all our actions and we are free. So he's a compatibilist about a ubiquitous divine action and human freedom. And he begins to shift in the 1760s and 70s. And then the 1770s is called the Silent Decade, because he doesn't publish anything. But we got lots and lots of his lecture notes, fragments. And he's kind of tortured. And I went looking for why, because what's happened is his concept of what meaningful human freedom is has shifted. And it's not because of a scientific discovery, and it's a conceptual shift, a theological shift, sort of a theological problem. And I wasn't able to find a single clear reason for the shift. There's clusters of concerns. One seems to be Rousseau. Rousseau's important. So he's very impressed by Rousseau's notion of the general will at a macro level, the idea of an autonomy of the people. So perhaps he's applying that at the micro level to the individual. Rousseau writing about slavery, about the dignity of the common man, this is important to him. He becomes more interested in freedom needing to be a liberation from authority, both in secular terms and religious terms. He is worried about how we can impute responsibility to human beings. What he's not worried about, interestingly, at any time, is the problem of evil. No interest in getting God off the hook because of the free will defence, and indeed in 1790s writes a critique of all attempts at theodicy. So that's not a concern for him, as it often is for people who want to have this sort of account of freedom. That's the best I can do, really. I don't really know why he shifts, but these are the concerns I've been able to track.
So So it sounds like you're saying you think it ultimately comes from a certain political conception about rejection of certain kinds of political authority, and therefore kind of...
I think that plays a role, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I do.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for this incredibly illuminating, this confusing obviously the comment about thinly disguised Platonism was really, luminous observation. So I wanted to sort of follow up on the relation between metaphysics and ethics, or theoretical and practical reason. Because here on the dunghill, when we read our founding fathers, it's often very hard to figure out what theoretical reason is, right? So it's pretty clear in Aquinas.
Yes.
It's extremely clear in Kant, but this, especially this society, practical reason kind of does everything.
Yes.
It's hard to figure out if theoretical reason is even a workable concept. So I just wanted to sort of flag that point to say it was fascinating hearing you talk about Kant, because he seems to be almost the opposite of a lot of what goes on here. Because it doesn't sound like he actually has a working concept of practical reason, or it's hard to intuit what actually it does.
Right.
And I thought it was fascinating in that connection that you chose to contrast him with Charles Matthews, who also seems to tie metaphysics and ethics pretty directly together.
Yes.
So another way to say it is the tradition out of which this society tends to work presumes that there's a significant gap between
That's right.
ethical thought and metaphysical thought.
That's right.
They're not disconnected, but
yes.
you can't presume to get from metaphysics
yes.
to ethics. In that sense, it's kind of a counter tradition to English valorization of philosophy, analytic philosophy of a certain type.
Yes.
That's
helpful.
Useful to hear you talk through a little bit more about how you see the theoretical and practical reason working.
And indeed, I think one of the gifts I feel I've got from wasting my early middle age on reading Kant is I think he's very rich actually on a variegated but unified structure of reason, so that reason has different textures and different tasks, and only a small part of reason is concerned with knowledge, and it seems for Kant, he even tells us, not the most important part. He even says that the first critique ultimately has a moral purpose, is sort of a... And I also find in Kant that although they have distinct tasks, he's very insistent on the unity of reason ultimately. It is a single thing, reason, it's us encountering the world, but with different tasks. And so you get this sort of reciprocal dance between parts of reason which are able to inform each other. So, for example, that if practical reason needs to believe in freedom, then it can, and it can sort of put that belief on theoretical reason. So there's sort of grounds for warrant which arise from ethics. So on the basis of ethics, you can make metaphysical claims. I think that is part of very ancient tradition there in Plato and Aristotle. A lot of it is driven by, I suppose I'm influenced by Pierre Hadot's reading that tradition, but a lot of it's driven, isn't it, as a way of life, ways of practicing, and then you conceive of the universe in a certain way on the basis of that sense of the good. So I think Kant there is rich and is, as he often does, remembering something which quite soon after gets forgotten. Ironically, partly because of him, but he's remembering it. Yeah.
Thank you very much for a great lecture. Just to elaborate a little bit further, the interesting passage about happiness as the whole of whose existence goes according to his wish and will.
Yeah.
Could you say a little bit more about that conception of happiness as opposed to the more eudaimonistic conception found in Aquinas?
Yeah, good.
And to what extent might that comparison both help us understand the radicality of what Kant is saying?
Yeah.
And then the second point is I've noticed, particularly in light of the question about evil, you haven't mentioned much about postulate of immortality.
No, that's true, I haven't.
If you could say a little bit more about that.
Sure. No, good. Okay. What I think is fundamentally going on in this passage, the whole of whose existence, according to his wish and will. I mean, I obviously can't show you all the texts and moves, so I'll just say it. It is that what Kant thinks is the inner value of the world is freedom. And what matters about freedom is setting an end, having an end. And everything flows from that. And he says this. He says, what is of value is setting an end, not because it's this particular end or that particular end. So I've sometimes thought of it as, you say, it's the project of end setting is that which has value, which is the project of freedom. So the kingdom of ends is where all of us, noumenally, are reciprocally setting ends which are harmonious with everyone else setting ends. So it's intrinsically communal. No, it's a rather weird community, I grant you that, but it is communal. So the kingdom of ends, this is why I think what the formula for the categorical imperative, they're all trying to track universality, that it's harmonious, that it can be harmoniously and universally willed. And what is happiness? Well, happiness, actually, I think, is just that. I mean, he talks about happiness in various places like this. He said, if the laws of freedom worked and everybody did this, happiness would be the proper result. Happiness would be the natural result. So happiness, the final state of happiness, is a state where we are all reciprocally and universally and harmoniously willing ends that are compatible with each other. So, in its defence against some critiques of Kant, it is quite a dynamic notion, and there's lots of ends in it, lots of end setting, in a way, lots of desires, but those, it has to be harmonious, universal desires. And happiness is terribly important, but everybody has to be happy, and everybody has to be happy for the right reasons.
But doesn't this set up the primary problem then? Because if the will is not right, and it's unified with wish, we could have the demonic.
Yeah.
So that's why it's only the good will is the only good thing in this or any other universe.
Exactly. And I think it's why it's very hard to see, given the restraints upon what God can do and the restraints upon grace, how God can achieve the highest good when God is only believed in order to sustain the possibility of the highest good. And so the postulate of immortality, what it does there is that the highest good is happiness in proportion to virtue. So God guarantees the happiness bit. Immortality guarantees our ability to infinitely progress in virtue. But he doesn't talk about it all that much, and it's a rather weird postulate, because what does this sort of infinite progression of immortality mean in the context where our proper selves are atemporal? And it's hard to... And I suppose true to his epistemic discipline here, he doesn't speculate much, but whatever it means, it means that our temporal death is not... it's just an appearance, it's not... not the end.
And he doesn't allow an assessment of progress in the moral life.
Not by human beings.
Not by God human beings. So how do we assess progress in this in relation to immortality?
Yes. I suppose we...
How do we judge it?
That's right. God is the judge. God judges us. But we are... he says we can't make categorical judgments, we can never know. We are allowed a sort of inference. Things aren't going so well here. Must be. In other words, even that's a bit misleading. It's not supposed to create a situation, I think, a psychological state where you sort of go around and think, oh, weird, I'm in the noumenal realm. You're supposed to live in this world and think about moral problems and try to improve. It's not supposed to create a sense of illusion. It keeps safe and sustains the possibility of freedom. But because, I think it's partly because it doesn't appear in this place or that place, it's
illusive.
a bit like, it's an analogy, a partial analogy, and a bad analogy in some respects, but I suppose we hear, some of you might be physicists, you hear from physicists tell you that fundamental reality is something extraordinary. I don't even know what it is, but you know what I mean, quarks and electrons, and that's fundamental reality, and this is the experienced world. But knowing that doesn't sort of, in some sense, make us or make physicists less interested in eating their dinner and looking after their bodies. And think, so it's, I think it's a, that level of an account of fundamental reality is different because it makes it, it somehow consoles and sustains and protects certain moral projects. But I don't think we're supposed to go about. So for, in the groundwork of the Metaphysics of Morals, he talks about a lot. But in the Metaphysics of Morals, much later in the 1790s, where he's actually trying to apply it, it's not coming up all over the place. He's dealing with empirical complexities.
Okay. Andrew Errington, University of Aberdeen. Thanks so much for your lecture. I wanted to ask a question about time.
Okay.
You differentiated Kant from Christianity partly on the basis of time and Christian eschatology's commitment to temporal transcendence. I think it's fair to say that that is a commitment that has been at times cloudier than it probably could have been in Christian theology. And the examples you drew on were mainly contemporary readings of Augustine, I think. Do you think there's a messier story to tell about the clarity of that version of transcendence in Christian theology? And if so, do you think that might complicate the decisiveness of the difference between Kant and Christianity?
Okay. Yeah, that's a very good question. I'll have to think about that, and people here might be able to help me. If I mean, it would, Augustine and Aquinas, it's important, I think, that the resurrection body is in some sense in a space and a time. God, of course, is outside of space and time. What Kant seems to do, this Platonic Platonizing strand, is to put us in the same sort of space that God is in, where it's one of the features of the difference between God and, unless you're an open theist, but the God in time, one of the features of it being God in contrast to the creation, that God has this relation to time. But of course, I mean, the picture is always more complicated, isn't it, than these? It's always more complicated. So there'll be strong Platonic strands running through Christianity, which tend to push you more towards non-temporal souls, non-temporal, non-spatial souls. That's right. That's right. That's a good question. No, thank you.
Familiarity with the eschatology of the Lutheran...
That's right. And, of course, I mean, even in Leibniz, of course, Leibniz thinks that we're fundamentally non-spatial and non-temporal, but still has God as our final object, and God acting in all our actions. So you can have perhaps a lot of the core of the doctrine, which... So in a way, my paper, one strand is, look, on these key aspects of the highest good, God is the final object, God is concurring cause. It's right that even, you know, you can certainly have a version of that where we are outside of space and time. Leibniz has it. So of course you can. So that's one claim, the claim that Kant studiedly distanced himself from traditions of Christianity, I suppose, is made on that basis. So then the contrast with Augustine is more just trying to create a bit of a hermeneutic for thinking about how we might engage with this and with the notion of different structures of transcendence. But I grant you, that's right. I mean, there are other ways of conceiving transcendence. And there are, of course... Well, I won't wait for someone to think of this objection. I won't put it out there.
David Chaffee, University of Chester. Thanks so much, Chris, for the paper. Among all the other riches, I'm absolutely gripped by the conjunction of this word from Kant to the English about foreigners dying on the dunghill.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, isn't it?
I mean, can Kant help us think about refugee crisis? I mean, is it just that the British are bad about thinking universally or universal respect for persons, or are there other things that he's seeing as a defect in British moral thinking that is leading to that eventuality?
Well, in a way, it's a... I mean, all I have to say is it's just so stunningly obvious that it wouldn't be worth... I mean, Kant thinks the British are insular. They live on an island. It's kind of like... that's not very illuminating, is it? I can't... I mean, Kant's view about cosmopolitan right, which is the right that states have to foreign individuals, is that everybody has a right to present themselves anywhere. So this is sort of speaking, you know, nominally, as it were, and nobody is more entitled to live on one part of the earth than another part. Everybody has the right to present themselves anywhere. They don't have to be allowed to settle, but they must be if there's a danger of death. So that's kind of, I don't know, but there'll be other people here with far more illuminating analyses of the current dire political ethos.
Another question at the back?
I just wanted to go back to your understanding of how Kant views social sciences.
Okay.
How these can be conducted.
Yeah.
My understanding is that can only happen at all if two people share then a common language, and that is based on free will and a rational mind. Anything else makes social sciences impossible, or that study impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps you can clarify.
So, just make sure I've got the edge of your question right. How is social science possible?
Yes.
Why is that a particular problem for Kant? It is a good question, but why is that? Or...
I guess my question is, coming back to his understanding that there needs to be empirical facts, is are there any other things that, you know, can be studied in the social sciences that are not empirical facts? Particularly with social sciences,
right,
where we don't only rely on empirical facts.
Yes. Yes. Yes, good. And I think there's his fundamental picture would be the same across the board. Noumenal reality, sustaining and generating outside of space and time, but it generates a very rich textures of appearances, each of which needs its proper modus of study. So he's quite good, I think. You know, so you read his lectures on anthropology, psychology, they're attentive, they're hermeneutically quite rich, they're attentive to the type of object it is. So he thinks that reason has to sort of reach out and theorise appropriately about the type of appearance that is there. I feel I'm not giving you much help there, but I mean, what he doesn't do, for example, this is a sometimes deflationary readings of Kant, such as you get in Rawls, would say something like this about the non-spatial, non-temporal. They say, well, of course he doesn't really believe this, but he just thinks it's a useful way of thinking about, say, morality or society. So Rawls is, veil of ignorance is that, isn't it? Imagine we're outside of space and time. But I think Kant doesn't think it's a useful way of thinking at all. It's there in his thought because you need that space to protect the possibility of sheer freedom. But it's not a useful way of thinking about how to then set up societies as such. So it is curious the way in which deflating it, the commitment to it, can actually make it do more work in your thinking about social science than I think Kant would want you to do. It's the groundwork of metaphysics and morals. You build on groundworks. But perhaps we could talk after if I've not grasped you.
Yes.
Hi.
Thank you very much for a wonderful paper. I was just wrestling with
It's actually a quote which sets it out rather nicely at the bottom of page 3, where he talks about moral actions in the phenomenal world having a noumenal counterpart, their schemata of
yeah.
actions. That puzzles me a bit. I can understand how God is noumenal, the soul is noumenal, freedom is noumenal. But how do moral actions be noumenal if the noumenal is the domain that is outside space, outside time, outside cause and effect, and so on? Moral action, moral behavior, how can they have a noumenal counterpart?
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, I think it's this. I think when thinking about Platonism, you've got a fundamental option. You can think of it as being two worlds. It's the same as in Kant studies, actually. Or you can think of it as being one world with degrees of intensity. I'm convinced that Kant's way of thinking about it is, it is one world. So you get, is it a two world or one world interpretation? No, it's one world with degrees of intensity and degrees of unveiling. So it's not that the noumenal world is somewhere else. What is this? This is nothing other than the appearance of that world. So what we are seeing now is, in a sense, that world, but partly disclosed through the forms of space and time. So everything that appears is nothing other than an appearance of the noumenal realm. So it makes the relationship, it's a bit like, people have different reactions. So there's a way in which thinking of God as being outside of space and time can either make you feel the spiritual consolation and excitement of the intimacy, therefore, of God's total relationship to every moment in time. Or it can make people think, well, that's kind of weird and spooky and uninvolved. And I suppose it's the same here, that I think Kant thinks of it as being intimately involved, but
I mean, even to say God is outside space and time is to employ a spatial metaphor.
Language
breaks down.
It does, exactly.
And you see this problem in Anselm and Aquinas, you know, what we mean when we say that God is omnipresent.
Yeah.
Some parts of Anselm, he says things like, well, that means that God is nowhere.
Yes.
Other parts, he says, well, it means God
is yes, that's right.
And so holding those two helps to resist the spatial metaphors creeping in.
And I should probably talk about that in some sense, that rather than always talking about atemporality, you can talk about omnipresence in time. So, you know, it's that sort of.
We need to draw our session to a close. Thank you, Chris, so much. You've set lots of things going, and I'm sure we'll generate conversations with those of us who've heard you tonight. Thank you very much for your contribution.
Thank you so much. Thank you.